If we lost VAWA here in Alaska, it would devastate. I mean, devastate our work here.
Native groups worry Congress won't reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, design possibilities for the proposed Susitna-Watana Hydroelectric Dam.
One of the questions we get a lot is, can you build these things in an environment like this? And absolutely.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech.
Negotiations are reportedly ongoing between House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Vice President Joe Biden about reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, key provisions for Alaska are at stake.
The last reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act in 2005 called for a national baseline study of domestic abuse victims in Indian Country. It did not include Alaskan Natives, which was likely just an oversight. But the current reauthorization, which has passed both the House and Senate, would include them in future studies. And U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says that could lead to more money for domestic violence services in the state.
It helps us in our ability to obtain additional grant dollars. Those federal funds that would be available to help on issues that relate to domestic violence, whether it's the shelters, whether it is just levels of support for victims of domestic violence.
There are a few sticking points between the House and Senate versions. The Senate extends protections to immigrants and gays and lesbians. It also grants tribal courts in the lower 48 the ability to issue restraining orders against non-natives. Mary Lundquist is a senior assistant attorney general for the state. She says that last provision is already in effect in Alaska, even though, in her eyes, the tribal courts are on shaky footing.
Whether they have the authority to do it or not, I don't think has been litigated, but it is done. And the policy of the state of Alaska that when a protective order is issued, the state enforces them and asks later.
Both Senators Murkowski and Mark Begich voted for VAWA, as it's known in D.C., and Congressman Don Young voted for the House version, too. Leaders of the House and Senate could appoint a conference committee to reconcile the differences and then have both chambers pass that fixed version. Or one chamber could pass the other version, though that's unlikely. Many thought the tension over politically sensitive groups would die after the election, but it hasn't. And Peggy Brown is nervous the Violence Against Women Act will sunset for the first time.
If we lost VAWA here in Alaska, it would devastate. I mean, devastate our work here. Prevention work that we're doing, public awareness, you name it.
Brown is the executive director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Her group provides victims with emergency shelters, hotlines, clothing, food. It also uses a federal grant to help victims pursue civil trials. The network uses the money on training. Veteran attorneys mentor newer ones so domestic violence victims don't get stuck with a lawyer who doesn't know the ropes of family court.
And we've been doing that for about 15 years, and so we're one of the few states that has received that grant every year for 15 years.
Brown says nearly all of her $3 million budget comes from the Violence Against Women Act. The state does chip in some money and resources. But she worries if the bill lapses, there is no way the state could cover the federal contribution. And that means less services for the people who need them most. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A second former executive... executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, has been sentenced in Anchorage's federal court for stealing from the organization. The U.S. Attorney's Office says in a release that 52-year-old Teresa Judkins of Barrow will serve 6 months in prison and pay more than $100,000 in restitution. Judkins led the commission for 2 years until her 2008 firing. She was charged in 2011 with using commission funds to travel and buy a snow machine. She was also charged with taking payroll advances that she did not pay back. Another former executive director, 62-year-old Maggie Amawak, was sentenced for embezzling last month. She was ordered to serve more than 3 years in prison and pay back more than $393,000 to the organization, which works to preserve subsistence hunting of bowhead whales for Alaska Eskimos. Preliminary engineering is underway for the proposed Susitna-Watonna Hydroelectric Dam. The state has hired Colorado-based MWH Global to develop designs for the project, which would provide rail belt power. MWH President and CEO Alan Krause gave a presentation at the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation luncheon last week. Krause, whose company has been involved in the engineering of several major hydro projects around the world, says Susitna can be compared to a recently completed dam in Iceland.
It's very, very cost-effective. It's a structure that is almost identical to, at least in a conceptual perspective, what we see at Susitna-Watonna. And it produces almost the same amount of megawatts. And it's in a very cold region, remote region. So one of the questions we get a lot is, can you build these things in an environment like this? And absolutely.
Krause says his company is looking at various locations and design configurations for the Susitna project, based largely on environmental studies. Critics of the dam cite concerns about impacts along the Denali Highway, including to salmon and caribou. Alaska Energy Authority preliminary data proposes a 700-foot-high dam near Devil's Canyon, which would create a 41-mile-long, up to 2-mile-wide reservoir. Krause, who grew up in the Denali area, says the reservoir is expected to be much smaller than is required by most major dams.
In that part of Alaska, you get very incised canyons, which are steep, and you don't have to see these broad floodplains that you would normally see in a flatter environment. And it was very interesting for me when I looked at it that the impact didn't look like a big impact to me. Now, I'm an engineer, and I'm used to seeing a dam, and then you have a big reservoir behind it. That's not the way this looks today.
Krause says projections show that the river would look fairly similar up and downstream of the dam. The MWH design work is part of an estimated 6-year Federal Energy Regulatory Commission permitting process for the multi-billion-dollar Susitna-Watonna project. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a unique approach to learning Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion.
In one of our first designs, we had a flat track and a loop-de-loop, and the ball barely made it up the loop-de-loop, so we had to make more speed.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
While the rest of Alaska is done with elections for a while, one is heating up in Petersburg. Voters there are deciding this month whether to create a new borough in Southeast. The proposal would dramatically expand municipal boundaries and the tax base for Petersburg and increase the population by about 10%. Joe Viknicki is a reporter at KFSK in Petersburg and has been following the issue. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Laurie.
So, Joe, just how contentious has this discussion become in town?
It's been one of the most hotly contested local issues in a few years, at least. I wouldn't say the town is divided over the issue. The debate has been pretty strong and vibrant, with people with strong opinions on one side or the other. The yard signs have gone up around town, both for and against the borough, and definitely the debate has filled the commentary space on the local airwaves on our radio station, as well as the editorial page in the local newspaper. So it's been a pretty vigorous debate.
What would you say the main points are for both sides?
Supporters of the borough say they want to have a greater input in land use outside of city limits. They're also saying they want the expanded tax base. The new borough would expand property tax, sales tax, and bed tax outside of the city limits of Petersburg. That gives potential for more revenue to come into the new municipality. And they also have talked about a concern about other municipalities annexing some of the lands that are in Petersburg's backyard. On the other side of things, opponents are obviously not excited about paying new taxes. They are also not interested in being part of a municipality right now. Some of these residents are in a pretty remote area and get to their land only by float plane or boat, and really wouldn't have any new services with this new municipality expanding to include them, and don't see the point in paying new taxes to support the municipality and be part of that.
Joe, I understand Juno is also keeping an eye on this vote. Tell us why that is.
Sure. Juno has filed a petition with the state to annex some of the same lands into its borough, the city and borough of Juno. And the decision by the state's local boundary commission back in this summer put a lot of that land into a Petersburg borough, assuming that voters approve a Petersburg borough. The city and borough of Juneau has appealed that decision to a court and is awaiting an outcome from the court. So they're also keeping an eye on the Petersburg borough vote. I think that will be more of an issue if the borough is voted down and Juneau has the chance then to go forward with the annexation of that land, or if that court decision comes out and really throws out what happens with the local boundary commission's decision from this past summer.
When is the vote?
It's going on right now, and it's a mail-out election done by the State Division of Elections. Most people have gotten their ballots in the mail, and the deadline to get the ballots back postmarked by December 18th. We should have early results posted to the State Division of Elections website by that time, and the target date to certify the election results January 3rd. So we should know by the end of the month whether the new borough has been approved or not.
Well, Joe, you live in Petersburg and know folks there. What's your sense of how this is going? Do you think it's likely to pass? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm worried about predicting an election. I'm really bad at calling these local issues. I would say, though, I've heard a lot more from the opponents, people opposed to the borough, over the past 6 months to a year time. If that's any indication, I would guess it would be failing. But, you know, it's hard to tell. I'm usually wrong on these kind of things, so I don't want to predict it.
All right. Well, thanks so much for helping us understand this.
Sure, no problem. Thanks, Lori.
Joe Viknicki is a reporter at KFSK in Petersburg. Over the last 3 years, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has collected energy use data on more than 1,000 publicly owned buildings in the state. Results show that energy-related improvements to public buildings could save more than $125 million annually. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
A number of well-known public buildings in the Fairbanks North Star borough were part of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's three-year energy audit. They include the Carlson Center, the Big Dipper, two public swimming pools, and 30 of the borough's 40 public schools. The Cold Climate Housing Research Center's research assistant, Dustin Madden, and building energy economist Nathan Wiltsy collaborated on the effort.
I would say that probably most people were surprised because before this paper, there was really no way to compare how much energy your building is using versus another building, right? And so a lot of people we talked to all thought they were doing great, and because, you know, they were. They were using less energy than they had in the past.
A group of 40 auditors and engineers statewide used a metric that considers regional heating degree days and building square footage to compare public buildings statewide. Overall, Fairbanks fared better than other cities across the state. Nathan Wiltsey says that may be due mostly to the high cost of energy.
You know, if you save 1,000 gallons of fuel in Fairbanks, there's $4,000. If you save 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas in Anchorage, well, you don't save as much on a per unit of energy basis. And it makes your simple paybacks or your returns on your investments much lower.
Dustin Madden says there was no silver bullet.
I think some of them were just overlooked basic maintenance, and that was kind of surprising. You know, like people left their heat tape on all the time, and so they're just constantly heating their water when they don't need to, even though it's summertime and it's not going to freeze.
Nathan Wiltsey says the report includes a list of 50 reoccurring problems that require simple fixes.
Another common one that was a bit surprising to us, and I think was surprising to probably a number of the auditors, was the number of control systems that have been bypassed at various times, either because of a cycle through in maintenance personnel or whatnot.
AHFC says Alaskans spend more than $641 million on energy each year. The study estimates an annual savings of $125 million. Wiltsey and Madden say they'd both like to see the state establish an energy efficiency code for its buildings. Those that got an in-depth energy audit also received a detailed list of recommended improvements. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Forecasters predict several inches of snow from a storm expected to begin overnight in Anchorage. Christian Cassell, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, says the storm formed in the Pacific and is pushing across the Bering Sea, moving onshore in southwest Alaska.
We have freezing rain advisories for the Bristol Bay and Kuskokwim Delta regions, and then the system will be moving north and east into the Kenai Peninsula. And there it's going to be mixing over with rain, so we're not expecting significant accumulations by any means there. Here in Anchorage, we should stay just cold enough to stay all snow until the front passes.
The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory for Anchorage. Cassell says the flakes should start flying near midnight in Anchorage, with 4 to 7 inches of total accumulation. Some areas to the north are expected to get a foot or more of snow, including in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. Thick stands of young trees surround Election Creek near Klawock on southeast Alaska's Prince of Wales Island. The forest was logged in 1989, and it's been left to grow back on its own. Now, more than 20 years later, Sea Alaska Corporation is getting ready to thin the crowded stands of trees that have returned. KRBD's Layla Carey took a tour with Sea Alaska timber officials on some of the corporation's Prince of Wales Island land and has the story.
Ever since 1971, when Sea Alaska selected land through the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, the Juneau-based corporation has logged. Most of that logging has taken place on Prince of Wales. What might be less known is how the corporation manages its property following a clear cut, in hopes of restoring tree stands quicker for future logging. That makes the forest more profitable over the long term and creates what Sea Alaska officials say is improved habitat for deer.
And I'm not going to try to tell you guys that following timber harvest, it looks pretty. It doesn't. It looks rough.
That's Ron Wolf, Sea Alaska's natural resource manager. He says the corporation's logging operation includes taking care of the land after it's been harvested. A clear cut is not the end.
That is the beginning of a next forest. And that happens within the first year. We have this a burst of understory vegetation that's important for deer.
Wolf says the deer habitat grows along with the new trees. After about 15 years, though, the trees start crowding out other vegetation. That's when Sea Alaska sends out crews for pre-commercial thinning. They remove some of the young trees, favoring the most valuable ones, in order cedar, spruce, and hemlock. That practice is good for business, but Wolf says it also extends the time frame for deer browse to grow. Another silviculture practice is basal pruning. Crews remove emerging limbs to create larger pieces of knot-free wood. Wolf says that allows more light to filter to the forest floor, improving deer habitat. Sea Alaska saves the expensive pruning work for where it will do the most good.
And I've come up with some criteria that the first thing is I want it to be below 500 feet in elevation. And that's because a good part of the reason why I'm pruning is for deer. Well, winter habitat for deer tends to be below 500 foot in elevation.
So why all this concern over deer habitat? Sea Alaska has approximately 21,000 native shareholders, about half living in southeast. Many hunt for recreation and for subsistence. Wolf said it's also concerned about the general health of the forest, which includes habitat for the animals that live there. He says Prince of Wales Island has a healthy deer population, and he believes logging is the reason why. Bob Kloss, a POW resident and forest program manager for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, has a different point of view. He agrees that the understory vegetation following a clearcut provides great browse in the summer. The problem is winter.
Winter habitat for deer, meaning the big trees where they can move around without snow, is gone. And the habitat is lost until some trees die and other ones grow back, and you start to get characteristics of old-growth forest again that's good for deer both in summer and winter.
Also of great concern to Alaska residents is salmon, and Sea Alaska keeps an eye on salmon streams that might be affected by its logging activity. Seattle-based fisheries scientist Doug Martin is a contractor working for Sea Alaska since the 1990s to help monitor fish habitat. On a recent visit to Election Creek, Martin pointed out that the 66-foot buffer is the minimum required by Alaska's 1990 Forest Practices Act.
It was pretty much driven by a study done by Mike Murphy and Kate Koski, the both Juneau residents, fisheries biologists. And they went and studied streams like this one we're standing on right here, and they looked to see where large woody debris comes from. And the reason why they wanted to know that is because as the trees fall down and fall into the stream, they create habitat. They create cover for fish. So if you didn't have that wood in the stream, it would be less complex and not as good habitat.
And it appears to have worked. Martin says there have been no negative impacts to fish habitat, and in some cases, habitat was improved because more trees in the buffer zone end up falling into streams. Martin notes that a healthy and diverse ecosystem benefits the whole forest.
The emphasis on the deer is really important, but it's really obvious by creating all this understory vegetation, you're just simply increasing biodiversity for everything. Bugs, bugs and voles, and biodiversity is becoming a huge issue.
Kloss sees a problem. Improving habitat is great, but there's no measurement of how many fish or deer were there before logging.
I don't think we ever will know. I think, you know, bigger buffers are better. You know, leaving streams undisturbed is the best way to go.
Kloss knows Sea Alaska will continue to log its land. He says the corporation appears to be managing its forests well. Sea Alaska owns about 290,000 acres. About 40% of that is designated for selective harvest, and about a quarter is not forested. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
How do you get 135 third, fourth, and fifth graders to learn and apply Sir Isaac Newton's laws of motion? Have them design and build paper roller coasters. KTOO's Casey Kelly takes us to the roller coaster riot.
The floor of the Juneau Arts and Culture Center is a mess of construction paper, tape, and elaborate design drawings. There are no rules at the roller coaster riot. Students are given kits that include various tracks, loop-de-loops, funnels, and corkscrews, and told to use their imaginations to create a roller coaster that gets a marble from point A to point B.
First, we got 30 minutes to plan, and then we went over there to that table and got the paper, some scissors, and some tape.
9-year-old Brianna McKeel stands next to her group's creation, the dolphin, so named because the twin starting tracks at the top resemble a dolphin tail. McKeel goes to Riverbend Elementary School, but for this project, she's working with students from other schools around the capital city. As part of the Juneau School District's extended learning program for gifted students, they've been learning about physics, specifically Newton's three laws of motion.
The first law is an object at motion stays in motion unless a force acts on it. And Newton's second law is an acceleration of an object is related to the force applied on it and is inversely related to its mass.
That second law is expressed in the formula F equals M times A, or
F equals mama.
McKeel also recites Newton's third law. For every action, or force, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In a paper roller coaster, she says there are two forces at work on the marble.
The force is from the gravity, like us like dropping it, and the way our tracks are tilted.
10-year-old Akbe Elementary School student Ben Ng says his group's roller coaster, the Ultimate, went through several redesigns to get the right combination of forces acting on the marble.
In one of our first designs, we had a flat track and a loop-de-loop, and the ball barely made it up the loop-de-loop, so we had to make more speed.
Ng says they solved the problem by making their roller coaster taller.
Gravity forces the ball to go down, and it builds up more momentum, so it goes faster.
Amy Jo Miners is an extended learning teacher at both Akbe and Riverbend Elementary Schools. She says Roller Coaster Riot is a great way to teach kids physics at an early age.
They have to use critical thinking skills, and they have to be creative in their problem-solving approaches, and it's a great setup to do that.
The activity is a partnership between the school district and the Juneau Economic Development Council. JEDC's STEM education program is designed to expose kids to concepts and activities that lead to careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. The Roller Coaster Riot activity is partially funded by a grant from NASA. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
Crowley, working in Alaska for over 50 years, Crowley understands the importance of safe and reliable fuel delivery in Western Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and is proud to support public radio. CPDAlaska.com.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.